This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday. It's our week in review and another week in coronavirus lockdown for the Commonwealth. Just this afternoon, Governor Charlie Baker announced a new initiative to help curb the spread.
Enhanced tracing capacity is an enormously powerful tool for public health officials. And what we mean by tracing is that when a person tests positive, public health officials gather information from that person about who else they could have infected.
Earlier in the week, the governor extended the non-essential business and school closures and social distancing guidelines until May 4th, which he acknowledged is a tough pill to swallow.
My weekly visits with my 91-year-old father are phone calls, and I miss him, but that's just the way it is, and it's the way it should be, and it's the way all of us need to be as purposeful as we can be.
Also this week in Holyoke, at least 18 veterans have died from complications related to COVID-19. Here's Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse.
The veterans and everyone at the Soldiers Home, these are people that gave their all, risked their lives to protect all of us, and they deserve better.
Governor Baker changed leadership at the veterans facility, called in the National Guard, and is conducting an independent investigation into exactly what went wrong there.
This episode is a gut-wrenching loss that is nothing short of devastating to all of us. And our hearts go out to the families and the loved ones and the staff.
As we approach what public health experts anticipate will be a peak in Massachusetts cases in the next weeks, will we continue to have tragic episodes like the one in Holyoke? We have a panel now to join us to discuss all these developments in the coronavirus pandemic this week. First, we have Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. Welcome back, Marie.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Also with us is Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Hello there, Jennifer.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thanks. And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Tiziana.
We want you to join us, too. Give us a ring. Be part of the panel. How did you react to the week's events? How are you feeling about where we are in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts today? Are you worried about somebody you have who's an older adult in a facility like the Soldiers Home? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In this new normal, I can't see any of you, of course, because you're all remote, but I have been thinking about you. And before we get to the news, I just want to check in with each of you. How are you and how are you faring, Marie?
You know what? Given the circumstances that everyone's experiencing, I am well, thank God. My family's well. I always say, as long as the kids are good, we're good. And we're healthy. We're together. We're getting used to the new normal. The social isolation takes some doing. But if that's the only price we have to pay, then we're actually in great shape.
I'm glad to hear it. Jennifer, how about you?
Basically the same.
Good. And concise. And Anthony, how about you? How you doing?
Oh, it's nice of you to ask, Tiziana. As good as anyone could be doing, given this situation. So, you know, family, I agree with Marie, family as well, kids are good. And so we don't ask for a whole lot more than that. We're concerned about a lot of folks who aren't doing so well right now. So that's what we're thinking.
Yeah, and to that point, we've got a tough event to talk about first today in our week in review, which is the Soldiers Home in Holyoke this week. At least 18 veterans have died of the COVID-19-related complications, 12 of whom tested positive for the virus. What do you make, Jennifer Braceras, of the events in Holyoke?
Well, they're tragic. I mean, there's really nothing more that can be said about that. And certainly they indicate a need for an investigation, but I do hesitate to pile on when we're in a situation that is new to all of us and everybody's trying to do the best that they can. I think when the dust settles, we'll need to know more about what happened there and, institute best practices at that home and at other places so that it doesn't happen again. But I hesitate to cast dispersion when, you know, the facts on the ground are changing by the minute.
You know, Marie, that was actually what Jennifer is saying is one of the questions I wanted to ask you guys today. You know, as we look at this, and it is fresh It is raw, and we don't know everything. And I want to acknowledge that right up front. Is our going in position that this is just part of the tragedy of a pandemic of this scale, or is our going in position that somebody did something really wrong at Holyoke?
I think we don't know. I think I agree with Jennifer's analysis. And first, I want to extend my condolences to the families of the veterans. I think over 13, or now we're hearing 15, who have lost their lives. I mean, it's sad that they've served our country so well, and this is, you know, how they've come to an end. But we don't know, right? And we also want to understand that the people who are actually out there caring for everyone while we're home, they're putting themselves in harm's way. So I am going to, in Massachusetts, and I think in Boston, I think our government has been doing the best they can and our support staff to handle this unprecedented pandemic. And so what we do need to do is take the step back, see what develops on the ground, continue to support people, because this is a very tough time to be caring for others and not being able to be home to take care of your family. Support them in the work they're doing. I think the governor has taken the right steps and beginning to ask questions. I don't think you go in order to accuse. I do think it's important that we find out as quickly as we can how do we pivot off this? What do we need to do in other locations where we have our seniors? We know that our seniors are most at risk in this pandemic. And so we need to learn what we must as quickly as possible, put in the best practices where we must as quickly as possible in order to save lives.
Anthony, you've been following the governor all week. I know, because we've been doing it together with these daily press conferences. What comes next with Holyoke and with the other intensive care facilities? That's meaning that not in a technical sense of intensive care for older adults in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, well, in terms of the Holyoke Soldiers Home, I mean, I do think it's too soon to sort of figure out what happened, and that's why the governor has appointed essentially an outside investigator to look into what happened. But the governor raised an important distinction today, for example, between what happened at the Chelsea Soldiers Home, where there have also been some fatalities as well, and the Holyoke Soldiers Home. And the real question, one of the real questions about the Holyoke Soldiers Home that has to be answered, is about reporting. You know, he talked about if someone falls down the stairs, that needs to be reported at these state-run facilities. And so the big question is, how is it that these fatalities occurred and these tragedies occurred over what seems like, anyway, a number of days, and nobody heard about them? So
yeah,
that's sort of the big takeaway for me, and the sort of first question and the first line of inquiry that the outside investigator is going to have to pursue.
I do want to underscore that Alex Morse, the mayor of Holyoke, told us on Radio Boston this week that he was the one who was anonymously tipped off to what was going on at the site. And in fact, he was the one that essentially notified state officials of the fatalities and what was beginning to unfold there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I mean, I think there's that perspective. But then I think even from the reporting of this station, it indicates that, I mean, Executive Office of Health and Human Services is saying that they actually were reports. I guess the question is, reports to who?
To whom?
And were the official channels notified? Now, they may not have, the mayor, for whatever reason, was not in that loop, but it sounds like that someone in the state was notified about these deaths, though it did not, you know, veer out to the public.
All right, let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join our panel in reviewing the week, we've got Beverly on the line from Watertown. Beverly, join us.
Hi, how are all of you?
Well, thanks.
I wanted to bring up an issue that I've been thinking about for some time, that is for the last several weeks. And part of the reason I called is that I just heard our governor, Governor Baker, talk about a new program, a new plan for doing contact tracing, which is very, you know, excellent to hear about. But what I've been thinking all this time is that we here in Massachusetts are fortunate. For example, we have four medical schools, three of which are in Boston. We have a highly developed biomedical research, you know,
capacity
and industry. And what I'm concerned about, because of the lack of anything resembling decent federal leadership in this epidemic, I think there's an issue of equity and equality among the states, because every state does not have the kind of resources that we have here in Massachusetts, or for that matter, that New York has, that California has. There are some states, namely, I would say, the states of the old Confederacy, that is, the Civil War, mm-hmm. and the border states, that are incredibly lacking in their health resources, their health outcomes, and also distinguished by the fact that there's the greatest proportion of black people living in those states.
Let's give that to the panel. Yeah, I appreciate you raising the equity question so well, Beverly. Let's bring it to the panel. I want to start with Jennifer Braceras. Part of what Beverly did there was compare and contrast between federal capacity in other states and the capacity here in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because this large debate has started, you know, sort of raging on the internet in recent days about federalism and our constitutional structure and whether it is adequate to address, you know, a pandemic of this nature. But the fact remains that we do have a federal system that's mandated by the Constitution. The national government has limited enumerated powers. And, you know, the governors are on the front lines of addressing this epidemic. Now, federalism doesn't mean states' rights. It means that state and federal authority each have a role to play in cooperation with one another. And, you know, certainly there's room for a muscular federal response in certain respects in terms of funding for research and cures and financial relief, you know, economic relief and all of that stuff. But really, the governors are the ones who have the power to issue quarantines and stay at home and shelter in place orders. The president can't do that, nor would it necessarily be wise to do that because, you know, the situation on the ground in Oklahoma is very different than the situation on the ground in New York City. So I think everybody is really just doing their level best to solve this and to help. And I don't think really this is the time to cast blame about the leadership of one governor or another or the president. I think we just all need to come together and do our own, you know, play our roles.
So there are two things I want to pick up there, one for Anthony, one for Marie. But because of that last thing you said, I'll go to Anthony first. So Anthony, Jennifer's saying not the time to cast blame on governors or the president. I hear you, Jennifer, at the same time, and I want to get some Anthony reaction to this. There have been huge disparities in how governors have reacted. Mm-hmm. And what's on my mind is how long ago Governor Charlie Baker put at least an advisory to stay at home versus Ron DeSantis in Florida, who only did something on that midweek this week. Anthony, how do we characterize the range of response from governors around the country?
Well, I think that's the sort of issue that we have to consider. I mean, this is a federalist system, and governors do have a lot of authority, and they are on the front line. The problem is that a pandemic doesn't respect state lines and the concept of federalism. So, you know, I think there is a role for probably more robust federal leadership here. I mean, let's just talk about those stay-at-home orders. There's no question that a lot of the Republican governors are taking the cue, have been taking their cues from Washington, from President Trump. And while the president doesn't have the authority to say, you know, everyone has to stay at home, he certainly has the ability and the wherewithal and the bully pulpit to recommend that all states impose some kind of stay-at-home order. And the reason that's important is because the pandemic doesn't respect state lines. So if you have a neighboring state that is being very lax, for example, that could mean trouble for you. I mean, for instance, the standards that are being imposed in the state of Maine, for example, are wildly different than they are in Massachusetts. And that could pose a problem down the line with people motoring down 95 and into Massachusetts. So I do think there's a role for some uniformity of these standards, or at least these recommendations. And I think you've even been hearing it from state officials and some local officials in Massachusetts asking for a kind of uniformity across the country as well. And I think that makes sense.
Go ahead, and then I want to bring Marie on something else. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, the recommendations that we're getting from Dr. Fauci and the others are, you know, applicable to the country at large. And so we are getting advisories and recommendations that apply to the whole country. But That doesn't change the fact that the President of the United States simply does not have the authority to shut down the entire country and order a nationwide quarantine.
So, Maria, I want to pivot a little bit there. There's a different angle I want to get at. So let me ask you my question, and then you can go to town on both if you want. Beverly, yeah. The caller also talked about racial disparities, and I was really struck by some reporting in the Detroit News that at least 40% of those killed by the novel coronavirus in Michigan so far are African-American, and that far outstrips the proportion of the African-American population in Detroit and in the region and in the state.
So, I want to thank Beverly too for raising the issue of equity, because I don't think it's one that's being highly addressed. And so I get the idea that we are in a federalist, we have a federalist system, and in that system, you know, there's concurrent and exclusive jurisdiction both the federal and the states have. I also know that while the states have have exclusive video over public health and safety, that is always tempered by Congress and their power of the purse and how they can direct those funds to be used. It's also tempered by, you know, commerce, the role that the federal government plays over commerce and how it can direct and shift opportunity. And part of the problem that we're and we also know that it is that federalist system and the state system that created the inequities that exist in our society today. We could take the slavery conversation and move it forward, but we're still operating off a system that was built to discriminate against certain segments of people, and we've built systems on that without actually dealing with it. And as a result, we continue to see it play out in our democracy. So I'm not surprised. I think that we're seeing the disparities, and I think we're going to see that disparity across the country and even here in Massachusetts. And as much as we work at this, those disparities exist. We've been talking about disparities in economics across the state for a number of years now. The feds have put out reports. And so now we're talking about significant unemployment. And who are the first who are going to be unemployed? And what is the impact on the communities that have historically been discriminated against? In areas as in the Midwest, what you're seeing is some of the craziness that exists when people do not understand that health is a basic right, right? We, the Bill of Rights says the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, if you don't have life, then there's nothing you're going to pursue. And health is an underpinning of all of that. And in the many places in the Midwest, where we walked away from this idea that we should give some people some basic coverage, where many of them fought against the individual mandate, you have scores of people who can't afford health care. And so if you don't put in place, if the federal government, which they've now moved to, don't say, hey, by the way, you don't have to pay for being tested, you don't have to pay for being able to get treatment, then there's going to be inequities in how that's happened.
And so I'm going to grab it from you there, Marie. Mm-hmm. We have to go to a quick break. The clock will not forgive us on that. Marie St. Fleur, Jennifer Braceras, Anthony Brooks, stay with us. Our panel this week is discussing this week's events in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with the outbreak of the coronavirus. All of our panelists are still with us remotely. We have Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, Jennifer Braceras, a political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum, and WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. We also have you. Call. Be a part of the panel. Tell us what's on your mind this week. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We were just having a conversation about equity in our federalist system before the break. I was going to go to a call, but I think we lost that caller. But I do want to pick up here while we get the caller back on the line and actually talk about a set of questions that come up from the initiative launched today by the governor. One of our callers before the break talked about it, which is this contact tracking initiative, a 1,000-person call center designed to track the extended contacts of people who have tested positive for the virus, get in touch with those people, use that to do additional testing, provide services, etc. And I want to put it out to all three of you, both your reactions to that, and two questions. One, did it get done soon enough, and does it raise civil liberty concerns?
Well, I can jump in certainly on at least offer some sort of context on that first question, Tiziana. Listening to Charlie Baker lay that out and Dr. Joya Mukherjee, the medical director at Partners Health, who's going to be running this, you know, they were asked very pointedly if this was too late, given that so many people have already been infected and so many more people will be infected. And I was struck by what Dr. McCurchy said. She talked about having firsthand experience and knowledge of what happened in Sierra Leone, where the Ebola epidemic was centered, and talking about a community in Sierra Leone that was literally the last place where the last case of Ebola was found. And she talked about a similar contact tracing system that was set up there, and it helped end that epidemic. So she said, if they can do it there, we can't say that we can't do it here. And so this is really an effort to go from being on defense to getting on offense. I'm not in a position to know if it's too late, but I would defer to someone like Dr. Joya McCurchy and sort of admire her determination and belief that this can be done, and it's a way to get out in front of this pandemic one day soon. And the alternative, she said, is we can just wait. We can just wait until 60% of the population is infected and hope for some kind of herd immunity. But they don't want to do that. They want to try to take an initiative and go on the offensive, and so that's what they're doing. And by the way, employing lots of people, and she talked about an interesting idea of aligning the high numbers of unemployed people with, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of folks who are going to be needed to make this initiative successful, to staff those call centers. So Jennifer, some interesting ideas there.
Jennifer, let me invite you to pick it up from there.
Well, I do think there are some, you know, civil liberties concerns with tracking every person that you've been in touch with. But at the same time, you know, this is a national emergency, and desperate times call for desperate measures. So if it would help as a temporary measure, then certainly I support that. You know, I think the problem with a lot of the measures that are taken in times of emergency is not that civil libertarians object to them during the time of emergency. It's that they worry that when the emergency passes, that the government will try to hold on to that power that was really only supposed to be temporary. And so that's the concern, not that you know, it will be used to solve this particular problem.
I'd like to grab a call here. We've got Sherry on the line from Brookline. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I tuned in later to the program, so I don't know if this has been touched on, but picking up on the previous caller, Beverly, and the issues of equity, I was reacting yesterday to the news about Baker and Kraft teaming up about bringing the gear from China, which seemed to be fabulous news in some ways and really great public-private, you know, partnership. But it was like, well, what about states that don't have PETs or don't have a Bob Kraft? On one hand, maybe many states do have other people, and it would be wonderful if that could be modeled in, you know, a way really shared. But I think it is a real problem with this state-by-state responsibility and
Great.
Loading it on the governors. And just want to add about the federal role, it is, I'm going to say it wrong, but the DPP, the Department of Defense, whatever, the act that Trump is not
the Defense Production
invoking.
Act?
The what?
The Defense Production Act?
Yes, yes. So that it has not been invoked, which is a federal power. And that's
an important point. Ooh, we lost you there at the end, Sherry. I apologize. So, Marie, again, there's an equity issue here, but there's also this, how do we scale up at a government, a national level with disparities in resources at a state-by-state level?
But that's the role in terms of the federal government's role over commerce. That is one role that they could play. Right now, they've got 50 states and territories fighting against each other for, you know, for equipment, for life-saving equipment. I mean, what is the purpose of the federal government if at this stage they cannot use the collective power of the United States, bring that to bear on the market in order to get ventilators at an appropriate price and then deploy them in a way that makes sense? Because Massachusetts actually has more power of a purchasing power probably than a lot of smaller states whose economies are not as steady and who don't have as much opportunity. So if you want to think that global equity, that is a real issue. And I think that's the equalizing impact that the federal government can bring to bear. And it has failed miserably to do that. And the other thing that it could have done is using, honestly, the CDC decided to go ahead and do their own tests rather than listening to, you know, the World Health Organization. Actually, many people started testing back in January, right? And so we had an opportunity to get ahead of that. So yes, a lot of
research. This is when the CDC refused the WHO test and chose to develop its own instead?
Its own, right? And again, that put us behind the eight ball, you know, which allowed this disease to take its toll in this country. Again, that's another place that the federal government could have stepped forward.
Jennifer, jump in. I have to jump in there and say that the failure of the CDC in that respect should make you question the power of the federal government to handle this appropriately, not make you want to have more federal involvement. And in fact, I would argue what we actually need and what we are seeing and what will ultimately solve this problem is the power of the private sector. And the power of the private sector racing to find a cure, racing to develop tests, and the power of individuals to, you know, keep their shops open longer, to sew masks, to get ventilators where they're needed. And I certainly would not want to see the federal government come in and ration resources and say, you know, just because we have a rich person in Massachusetts that's dedicating themselves to getting equipment into the Boston hospitals, that should be taken and somehow dispersed to areas of the
country. Jennifer, I want to jump in.
Suffering as much as we are right now. I mean, that is essentially socialism, and that is essentially what I hear Murray asking for.
So I would like to add a dimension.
No. Then that's exactly what we had to do after. What is the purpose of a federal government then? Why do we need them? Because that's the purpose that we were pulled together as a collective to have impact. I'm not trying to say, see, you took it to looking at, I am suggesting that the federal government does have a role it could have played. And it still has that role under that Defense Protective Act. We've used it in World War II because we understand that we are, as a state, we are responsible. We are a collection of states, and in that federalist experience, that we do have a responsibility to each other. And I am proud of the fact that they didn't simply go to Massachusetts, but they're helping out New York. But that is something that the federal level should have pulled together. We are one people. While we may inhabit different states, we are Americans, and we should be concerned about making certain that every American is okay, not just because in our corner of the world, we're doing better.
All right, Hey, everybody, give me a second to moderate from afar here. I want to give Jennifer a quick chance to respond to that, and then actually I'm going to shift gears as hard as that is to do. So Jennifer, quick response there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I obviously agree with that point, but, you know, not only is there an inequity in resources, but there's an inequity in which parts of the country are being hit the hardest. And so it's not the case that every state needs the same amount of resources. Each locality and state needs the appropriate level of resources to deal with the threat they are currently facing. And if there are private citizens in a particular jurisdiction that want to step up and help their community, then they should be allowed to do that without having those resources rationed and sent off to other jurisdictions.
All right, so I'm going to pull us back here. I want to go to our hubbubs in a second. And lately we've been doing those specifically focused on stories that caught our attention by inspiring us or bringing us joy. Before I do, I just want to note there were a lot of callers we didn't get to, and they were in the mix with you, Marie and Jennifer. We had people on both sides who were backing you up and bringing just a lot more forward about what you two were talking about. So I do want to move. I want to leave a little time for the joy and the inspiration this week. I don't know how many of you brought hubbubs. Anthony, I'll start with you. I don't know if you have one for today or not. If you not, that's okay.
But I guess I have a hubbub in talking about bringing a little levity and a little joy into a difficult moment. So I've been working remotely this past week from southern New Hampshire, and it's a nice place to be, and that's why I consider myself extremely lucky and fortunate in this difficult time. But I was struck by Monadnock State Park here in southwestern New Hampshire the other day, and I was taking a walk and getting some fresh air, and there must have been 30 cars parked at the bottom of the trailhead of Mount Monadnock. And it just occurred to me, you know, as bad as this pandemic is, getting out, getting into nature, climbing a mountain, having a long walk is a pretty good thing to do, and it's a thing that's available to a lot of people. And so I had just a moment there where I thought the whole world isn't completely askew. Now, I bring this up fully aware that not everybody can hop in a car and drive 70 miles to southwestern New Hampshire to climb a mountain. But the idea of the great outdoors being not far away from just about all of us, it might be sort of a great thing to do more than it ever was in this particular moment.
That's really nice. How about you, Marie?
Well, I'm going to piggyback on what Anthony had to say. One of my daughters is a runner. She's an avid runner, and she's feeling it. She's in L.A., and they've shut things down. And so I was trying to help her out. And so I've got this article about this British gentleman, James Campbell, who ran a marathon in his backyard. He turned 30. And he ran a marathon in his backyard, and he did it for charity. And I just think people are getting really creative about ways they can help and stay healthier, and I enjoy that one.
Yeah, my hat is off to him. That's intense. How about
That's
you,
amazing.
Jennifer?
What a great story.
Yep.
Well, I'm loving all the stories of people, you know, really all over the world, but in different neighborhoods coming out, performing music for their neighbors, people standing in their driveways and listening to performances and clapping for one another. And frankly, I think in some ways, in some places, seeing more of their neighbors than they might otherwise be doing during the month of March, particularly in New England. So I find that very encouraging.
So I do too. And I went out to this Twitter sphere and I asked listeners for sort of nominations of their favorite stories of inspiration. And my favorite this week came from Sarah Napoline. That's her Twitter handle. She said, quote, "This week, the Norwood teachers did a pride drive parade through neighborhoods to visit students and families. We live in an apartment complex with tons of little kids and parents. We just stood on our balcony and waved at everyone, neighbors included. It was so heartwarming. We heard honking. It wasn't a car alarm or a taxi, but short little beeps. We went to the porch and saw cars with balloons, signs like 'We miss you,' and the teachers' names written in windows. They drove slowly, honking, peering out, and looking for familiar faces. I waved and cried." And she sent a video that one of her neighbors had taken of the cars with the waving and the honking in this long parade. And we find a way to be in community with each other one way or another. And I just found it incredibly inspiring. So that's mine for this week. Okay. Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, CEO of a cannabis company. I really appreciate you joining us.
It's good to be here and wish everyone well. Please stay healthy, everybody.
Amen. Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hey, Anthony, thanks a lot.
Hey, my pleasure, Tiziana.
And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Bedlam in Boston Garden. Standing ovation as the Celtics are about to be introduced.
Now, wait a minute. I'm about to be introduced. Where's my standing ovation?
Yay! It's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, so I'm guessing we all know what we're going to talk about.
Tiziana, I don't know about you. We are in week three here of No Live Sports, and it is driving me crazy. There's nothing to watch to kind of get away and unplug a little bit from all of the hard, heavy news we've been dealing with during the week. And I'm sure you're feeling that too.
Well, yeah, and we have a particular heartbreak in our family this week because my daughter, who's a senior in high school, she and my husband have a tradition of going to opening day together. She'll be off at college next year and probably not able to do that. Red Sox opening day, home opener.
Yeah, right.
They were supposed to go yesterday. And of course, it didn't happen.
Right. So with that in mind, I was thinking it would be a lot of fun to kind of revisit some of the greatest moments in sports history. There's been this kind of resurgence. I say sports history. I mean Boston sports history. What else is there?
Because is there any other sports history?
No, there's been this interesting...
Wait, somewhere out there is a Yankees fan right now
screaming
at their radio.
It's fantastic. I love the back and forth. So there's been this surge of interest in kind of rewatching old games. And I thought kind of in that vein, let's look back at some of the greatest moments in Boston sports and figure out what should folks who are really itching to watch some ball what should they look for?
That's right. So pen and pencil out, take notes, because these are all things you can go find somewhere.
That's right. These exist mostly on YouTube. I wanted to start, as you said, yesterday would have been Fenway's opener. So yeah. I wanted to start with the Red Sox. And this is maybe a little bit cheesy to start with 04. But in terms of sports moments, it just doesn't get any better. So I know you hate this as a host. I have to set the stage a little bit.
Set the stage.
2003, the Red Sox get defeated on a game-winning home run by Aaron Boone. It was as close as they had been to the World Series in my lifetime, basically.
Because this was pre-breaking the curse for people on our
right.
and our listenership who maybe are not huge baseball fans.
Yeah.
We had not won the World Series since the teens.
Right, exactly. You're looking at 86 years here, coming off a brutal loss the year before. 2004, they are down 3-0 against the Yankees, and it just felt like, great, here we go again. They're down 4-3 in the bottom of the ninth in game four, and you just felt like, here we go again. Let's listen to Joe Buck describe it.
Just turned midnight here at Fenway Park. 12 hours ago, JB was welcoming an NFL television audience out in Foxborough. 12 hours later, the Red Sox are 3 outs away from being swept.
First of all, there's nothing worse than being swept out of the playoffs because it's like you didn't even show
it's like
up.
You didn't belong.
But to really kind of understand what they were up against, not only were they down 3-0 in the series here, they would have had to win 4 games in a row to
and
beat
what
the
team?
Yankees.
The Yankees.
The Yankees, right, exactly. This is when this rivalry was huge. You had Mariano Rivera on the mound for the eighth and ninth innings. He's the best closer ever. If you had to pick one guy throughout the history of baseball to shut down a lineup for 1 or 2 innings, it was Mariano Rivera. The guy was invincible. So, as I said, Sox are down 4-3, 3-0 in the series. There are 3 outs left. All of a sudden, Kevin Millar, in 5 pitches, 4 of them are balls, and he walks to first. And you kind of think, okay, Mariano Rivera doesn't walk guys much, especially on 5 pitches. It's crazy. He usually goes right at them because his stuff is so nasty. So all of a sudden, Dave Roberts checks in as a pinch runner on first base. Mariano Rivera looks a little nervous. He checks the runner 2 or 3 times, throws over to first base. Everyone in the stadium knew Dave Roberts is going to try to steal second. This is it. Dave Roberts is going to try to steal second. Even Tim McGarver and Joe Buck knew that that's what was going to happen.
That was close.
He's going.
He certainly got a lead big enough to go.
And sure enough, with Bill Miller at the plate.
Miller still waiting for his first pitch. Roberts is going. Posada's throw. Roberts, safe.
Goosebumps just hearing it. So it's kind of ridiculous that that moment, even in real time, had an electricity to it because... great, you stole second base. That's the tying run, not the winning run. The tying run, and you're still down 3-0 in the
series.
3 games,
right. Can you just, so, it's the, you're not coming back.
It just feels like, how could they possibly surround it? But there was something in the air.
There was.
And all they had to do was get Dave Roberts home, tie it up, send it in extras, right?
This season hanging on a bunt here.
Up the middle. Roberts will come to the plate. The throw by Williams. Bill Miller has tied it.
So that's the bottom of the ninth. You're already talking about past midnight now. Let's fast forward to the 12th inning now. You're well past 1 a.m. The 12th inning. Manny Ramirez steps up, singles, gets on base. Who but Big Poppy steps up?
Poppy!
Ortiz in the deep right field. Back is Sheffield. We'll see you later tonight.
I love that. See you later tonight. It's 1:30 in the morning. Nobody left the park. There was just something electric in the air. It felt special. I've watched a lot of sports in my life. In the moment, hindsight, obviously, everybody knows it was special. But in the moment, everybody watching this game knew something was happening here. They turn around later that night, game 5, 14 innings they pull off a win against the Yankees. And all of a sudden, it starts
There's
to
some
feel
momentum.
Like, wait a minute, wait a minute. And sure enough, they win 2 more, beat the Yankees, go on, break the curse. 86 years later, they sweep the World Series. One of the greatest moments of my life as a sports fan.
So there is so much joy to this, right? And this is why we relive those things. Well, it turns out the WBUR had somebody in the building for that. He was our guest already on the show today, Anthony Brooks. Are you there, Anthony?
Hey, yeah, Tatiana, I was there. I love the way Chris set up this, this
it's
moment.
It's fun, right? Yeah.
So, Joe Buck couldn't hold a candle to you, Chris.
Well, that's a compliment. That is one for the ages. All right, so the funny thing is you're a bit of a Sox fan and you were attempting to report on the game, Anthony, but what actually happened?
Okay, so, yeah, this is. I mean, it was a great opportunity. It was a great game. So I was there for NPR and WBUR. But here's the thing. As you said, I am a Sox fan, and I was doing my best to kind of display a kind of professional detachment like a professional journalist is supposed to do. It was also getting late. It was also getting cold. I also had sort of given up on the idea that the Red Sox had a chance to win this game. But there they were, tied in the bottom of the 12th inning. So every time a Red Sox hitter would come up to the plate, I'd walk out right along the box, the grandstand area, along the third base line, and turn on my tape recorder. Just in case something amazing happened, I would get the sound of Fenway Park erupting. So there on the bottom of the 12th, they're tied up. Ortiz is up at the plate, and sure enough, he swings hard and sends the ball right into, I think it was the visitor's bullpen. Fenway erupts, pandemonium, huge cheers. I'm recording the whole thing, and this is fantastic news. So then I get back to the studio to record my piece and put it together for NPR, and I think we have a clip to play from
yes.
that moment.
Let's do it right here.
Okay.
Bases loaded.
Ortiz blasted Quantrill's pitch into the Yankee bullpen, circled the bases, and jumped into the arms of his ecstatic teammates at home plate.
What was the screaming, Anthony?
So that very front of scenes, you know, yeah, that was me. That was me.
The consummate professional.
Professional detachment gone. And I had a long moment listening to the tape thinking, oh, my God, I can't use this because I'm screaming all over my tape. Like an idiotic Red Sox fan, but I decided that it was drowned out enough by 37,000 other people. But once you know that story and listen to that tape, it's pretty clearly me screaming all over that
tape. I mean, Anthony, back me up here. Something about that game is because the Red Sox had every reason to mail it in, basically, to just say, it's not our year, not going to happen, everything's against us, we'll try again next year. And it was the fact that they kept playing, they were scrappy, they just kept fighting when they had every excuse to give it up. I think that's what gave it the weight that moment really had. What do you think?
It's true. And I honestly, this sounds cliche, but there were a lot of people. I mean, there were 37,000 people there that evening, and a lot of them hadn't given up. Because I remember interviewing some fans when they were at the beginning of the game. And I talked to these guys, I forget where they're from, but the Boston area, and one of them said, we got nothing to worry about. We're going to win tonight. We're going to win three more. We're going to go down to New York and beat them there. And, you know, we've got this under control. And I sort of took
right.
the tape away and thought, yeah, right.
This is before right, Boston was title town. Like, all this right. was at
all
the
right.
beginning.
You've had your moment. I've got one I want to put in here, too. Right. Anthony Brooks, thanks so much for joining us for that.
You're
that
welcome.
Was a riot. Okay, so I've got one for you. We're going to fast forward to 2013 now, okay? Because this is a special memory in our family. It's the 2013 ALCS, the American League Championship Series. Yes, I know what that stands for. Thank you very much. Sox are
when
playing.
When that, you're in the World Series.
That's right. Sox are playing the Tigers, which you also have to understand. My husband and I were both born and raised in Michigan. So there's
oh,
a
I forgot
special
about the Detroit
tonight.
Connection here.
There's
okay.
a special tension to playing the Tigers. It's game two. Now, this was the year that the Tigers had pitching that should have just shut down
yeah.
all of
absolute
baseball.
Nasty rotation.
Yeah. So the Sox had been one hit by Anibal Sanchez in game one, and Justin Verlander was waiting to what one would assume is destroy.
Cy Young candidate,
right?
Justin Verlander. Yeah.
So in game three. So we're in game two, and Max Scherzer, who has been great, is pitching. The Sox are down 5-1. We're in the eighth inning, but suddenly we start getting runners on bases. Will Mitterbrooks, Dustin Pedroia. My husband and my daughter, Stephen Simone, the ones who couldn't go yesterday, are watching, and they tell this story. They're sitting there waiting to see what happens, and all of a sudden, Big Poppy comes to the plate to hit against the closer for Detroit, who they bring in to shut him down.
Bases loaded. Two out. Big
Wait for it.
The grand slam.
There it is. Grand slam.
Mr. Clutch.
Right. Grand slam. So now we're tied. We go into the ninth inning, and just to put the cherry on it, at some point Simone had stood on 1 foot. She was 11 at the time. So the two of them decided that you must, right? It's baseball.
Yeah.
So they watch the ninth inning standing on 1 foot.
They would be bad fans if
That's
they did
right.
not.
And the Sox come back and win it. And as you well know, what happened at the end of 2013?
World Series.
That's right.
Absolutely. And I want to point out that game you're talking about, that home run. That is the Cop moment with
That's
the Cop
right.
holding his hands up in the bullpen, who has now become a Boston celebrity.
That's right. If you don't know what Chris is talking about, you use your memory. You've seen somewhere a picture with two legs in the
That's
air
right.
because
Torrey Hunter,
the outfielder from the Tigers goes over the wall and his legs are up in the air next to the arms of the bullpen police officer who is cheering the grand slam.
Another consummate professional.
There you go. All right, Chris.
All right, so
I do want to
highlight some other sports here. And for me, basketball is the first love of mine. And growing up a Celtics fan at the time I did was a little rough. I had kind of just missed Larry Bird. I was a young child for the end of his
Youngin.
Career. But for most of the 90s and the early 2000s, the Celtics were not good. They had made one deep playoff run. And then all of a sudden in 2007, 2008, everything changed. The Celtics pulled off trade for KG, Kevin Garnett, and Ray Allen, and they created basically the first super team. All of a sudden, they were title contenders, and then they get to the finals, and they're playing the Lakers. Celtics, Lakers,
dun, dun, dun.
One of the greatest rivalries in sports. Game one, so, and I should point out, KG coming to Boston changed who Paul Pierce was as a player. He used to be kind of this selfish superstar just getting his points. KG shows up. They have this team defense mentality, becomes tough. He's a real leader of the team here. And so in the third quarter of game one of the NBA Finals, it looked like the Celtics could be in real trouble.
Certainly not the sight the Celtics and their fans want to see. Paul Pierce in a lot of pain, had to be carried off. Then they put him in the wheelchair as he's going back to the locker room. Obviously in a lot of pain, can't walk off on his own power. It appears to be the right leg.
Now, there's some interesting, somewhat gross stories about some of the things that happened while he's in that wheelchair. You can Google that on your own time. But about 5 or 10 minutes later, he comes back out of the
no
tunnel.
Way.
The place erupts. And just listen to this sequence.
And now this huge ovation as their captain and leading scorer returns. Rondo to Pierce. Pierce for three. Bang! Celtics back up by one. Rondo back to Pierce. Another three. Puts it in. Back-to-back three-pointers for Paul Pierce.
So I got to say, I was working an Amazing. Event on Causeway Street outside the Garden. You could hear fans on the street. That building was rocking. I recommend rewatching anything from that 2008 finals. It was a great series.
All right, we've got about 30 seconds left, although we could do this all day.
You know I could.
I know. So without getting any more great sound, can you name a couple others that you recognize, recommend listeners go find?
I mean, if you want to go football, obviously everybody jumps to Super Bowl 51, where the 28-3 comeback led by Brady and the Patriots pull off the win. My favorite, though, is actually Super Bowl 49 a couple of years earlier, 2015. The Seahawks basically get the ball on the goal line. They have it on the 1 yard line. Malcolm Butler comes up with the timeliest interception of all time, seals the game. Pats win the Super Bowl.
So go find them. And listen, tweet us at Radio Boston. I think we'd get a kick out of hearing what your favorite New England sports moments are to relive. Chris Siderick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks
today.
For having me. Didn't include any Bruins. Too painful still. I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We sure enjoyed having you as listeners this week. Join us again next Monday for more Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we'll talk to you again soon.